Welcome to Akatra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI.
Welcome. Today we're diving deep into a giant of literature, Fyodor Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment. And this isn't just about retelling the story. We really want to unpack its powerful argument against a certain kind of intellectual pride.
Absolutely. Dostoevsky, well, he's a profound explorer of the human soul. Born back in 1821, you can't really separate his writing from the Russia of his time, 19th century. Incredibly turbulent, lots of radical ideas floating around, nihilism taking hold with students.
And his own life experiences were so intense,
right? Oh, completely. You have to remember the years he spent in a Siberian prison camp. That experience fundamentally shaped his views on, you know, suffering, sin, guilt, and the incredibly difficult path toward redemption. It's all there in the books.
It really is. So Crime and Punishment, published in 1866, it just hit the scene like a thunderclap. It's part psychological thriller, part detective novel, but also this incredibly deep philosophical exploration.
Mm-hmm. A cornerstone of psychological fiction, really.
Exactly. And our goal here isn't to solve a mystery. We find out who did it very early on. The real questions Dostoevsky forces us to grapple with are the why do it, and maybe even more importantly, the what happens next. How does this character live with himself?
Right. It's like Dostoevsky puts this destructive idea on trial, and the trial takes place entirely within the mind of the person who acted on it.
So let's set the scene. Where does this internal trial take place?
Well, you're immediately thrown into the thick of 1860s St. Petersburg. And it's summer. Dostoevsky makes you feel the heat. It's sweltering, sticky, claustrophobic. Mm. The city isn't just a backdrop. It's almost like a feverish, oppressive character itself.
Reflecting the main character's internal state.
Perfectly. It mirrors the turmoil inside Rodion Raskolnikov. He's our protagonist, brilliant, a former law student, but incredibly poor, destitute even.
Living in that tiny room.
Yeah, he calls it his coffin-like garret. It's suffocating. And he's consumed by this intellectual arrogance, these dangerous theories he's been developing.
Okay, let's unpack that theory. The extraordinary man idea. What's it about?
It's pretty stark, really. Raskolnikov basically argues that humanity is split into two distinct types. You have the ordinary people.
The masses.
Right, the sort of conservative, law-abiding majority. They have to follow the rules, the moral codes, the laws. Okay. And then there are the extraordinary individuals. Think Napoleon, Lycurgus, the movers and shakers of history. Raskolnikov believes these figures aren't just allowed to break the rules, to transgress moral boundaries, even commit crimes like murder, but they sometimes have to if it serves a higher purpose, a greater good.
It's a justification for breaking the ultimate taboo, essentially. He needs to know if he belongs in that second group.
Desperately. He feels crushed by his poverty and insignificance, and this theory offers a twisted kind of escape, a way to assert power. So he concocts a plan to test it.
The murder's a pawnbroker.
Alyona Ivanovna. He sees her as this cruel old woman, a louse, a parasite sucking the life out of people. He convinces himself that killing her and using her money for good deeds would be, well, almost a virtuous act under his theory.
But the reality of the crime is completely different from the theory.
Oh, catastrophically different. He intends it to be this cold, calculated, almost philosophical act. But the moment he brings the axe down, it dissolves into just chaos and panic. He botches it, gets blood everywhere.
And then the unexpected happens.
Yes. The pawnbroker's half-sister, Lizaveta, walks in. She's gentle, innocent, completely harmless. And in his panic, Raskolnikov kills her too.
That second murder feels like the point of no return, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Maybe he could intellectually justify the first murder under his warped logic. But Lizaveta, there's no justification. It's pure panicked violence. And in that moment, his entire philosophical structure just collapses. It shatters. What's left is terror, nausea, and this profound sense of being utterly cut off from humanity.
So the punishment isn't waiting for the police to knock on the door.
Not at all. That's the genius of it. The punishment is immediate, and it's entirely internal. Dostoevsky shows us that the real consequence of violating moral law isn't legal, primarily. It's psychological disintegration.
What does that look like for Raskolnikov?
He falls incredibly ill, almost straight away. Fever, delirium, nightmares, terrifying hallucinations. He drifts in and out of consciousness. He becomes paranoid, seeing suspicion everywhere. He tries to act normal, but he can't connect with anyone. Not his friend Razumikin, not his family.
That isolation sounds like the worst part.
It is. He's trapped inside his own head with this horrific secret. The crime has built this invisible, impenetrable wall between him and everyone else. It's a living hell, created entirely by his own actions, fueled by his failed idea.
And into this personal hell walks Sonia Marmeladov. Tell us about her. She's such a crucial figure.
She really is the moral heart of the novel, isn't she? Sonia's situation is, well, it's devastating. Her father is a hopeless alcoholic. Her stepmother is consumptive. The children are starving. To save them, Sonia has become a prostitute.
A terrible sacrifice.
Yes, but here's the paradox Dostoevsky presents. Despite her circumstances, despite being socially outcast, Sonia possesses this incredible spiritual purity. She embodies humility, Christian love, forgiveness, everything Raskolnikov lacks.
She's the direct opposite of his pride and his reliance on reason alone.
Exactly. Where he tried to impose his will on the world through violence and logic, she endures suffering with faith and offers boundless compassion. She's the potential path to his redemption.
But before he can truly turn to Sonia, he has to contend with another figure, the investigator, Porfiry Petrovich.
Porfiry. He's not your typical detective at all.
No clues, no witnesses in the traditional sense.
Right. Porfiry works almost entirely through psychology. He suspects Raskolnikov very early on, not because of evidence, but through sheer intuition and understanding the criminal mind, especially the mind of an intellectual criminal wrestling with a theory.
So their interactions are like duels.
Absolutely. Verbal duels. Mind games. Porfiry circles. Raskolnikov drops hints, discusses abstract ideas about crime, watches his reactions. He lays these incredibly subtle psychological traps.
He wants Raskolnikov to break, doesn't he? To confess willingly.
Precisely. Porfiry understands that true justice, true punishment, requires the criminal to confront their own conscience, to choose confession. He's not just trying to lock him up. He's trying to guide him, almost force him, towards acknowledging the moral law he broke. It's fascinating and deeply unnerving.
While he's playing this cat and mouse game with Porfiry, another character emerges who seems to reflect Raskolnikov's own darkness. Svidrigailov.
Yes, Arkady Svidrigailov. He's a truly chilling figure. If Raskolnikov represents the theory before it fully corrupts the soul, Svidrigailov is what happens when someone genuinely tries to live beyond good and evil.
He embodies the theory taken to its cynical conclusion.
Exactly. He's wealthy, amoral, seemingly untroubled by conscience. He indulges his desires, his depravity, without apparent guilt. He overhears Raskolnikov's confession to Sonia, and he uses that knowledge.
And his pursuit of Raskolnikov's sister, Dunya.
Shows his complete lack of moral boundaries. Dunya represents integrity, moral strength. Svidrigailov's attempt to possess her, first through manipulation and then potentially force, is horrifying. But ultimately, even he finds his philosophy leads nowhere meaningful.
His suicide is quite stark.
It's presented almost as the logical endpoint of his worldview. A life without moral constraints, Dostoevsky suggests, leads to a kind of spiritual bankruptcy, an emptiness that ends in self-destruction. He's a warning. This is where your theory leads, Raskolnikov.
So, seeing this dead end in Svidrigailov and tormented by Porfiry and his own conscience, Raskolnikov is pushed towards Sonia.
Yes. He can't bear the isolation any longer. In a desperate, almost compulsive need to connect to break the silence, he goes to Sonia and confesses everything.
That scene is incredibly powerful.
It's the spiritual climax, really. He doesn't just confess, he almost challenges her faith with his crime. And then, significantly, he asks her to read him the story of Lazarus from the Bible.
The raising of the dead.
Mm-hmm. It's Raskolnikov unconsciously crying out for his own resurrection. He knows he's spiritually dead, killed by his own actions and ideas, and he senses that Sonia, with her unwavering faith, holds the key to some kind of rebirth.
How does Sonia react to the confession?
With horror at the act itself, naturally. But her immediate response is overwhelming compassion for him, for the sinner. She doesn't turn away. Instead, she tells him what he must do.
The famous instruction.
Yes. Go at once, this very minute, stand at the crossroads, bow down, first kiss the earth which you have defiled, and then bow down to all the world and say to all men aloud, I am a murderer. Then, she says, God will send him life again.
It's about public repentance, humility, rejoining the human community he cut himself off from.
Exactly. Rejects the pride, embrace the suffering, accept the shared humanity. And eventually, after more internal struggle, he does it. He goes to the police station and confesses. It's not an end to his suffering, but it's the crucial first step towards healing, towards choosing truth over the lie he'd been living.
So if we step back and look at the big picture, what are the core messages Dostoevsky is driving home here?
Well, first and foremost, it's a devastating critique of that kind of rational egoism, of nihilism, Raskolnikov's intellectual pride, his belief that his mind could override universal moral laws, leads directly to catastrophe and psychological collapse.
Dostoevsky seems to argue that morality isn't just a social construct. It's somehow woven into the fabric of being human.
Absolutely. Violating it doesn't set you free. It shatters you from the inside, which connects to the next major theme, redemption through suffering.
It's not a comfortable idea.
No, it isn't. But drawing on his own experiences, Dostoevsky presents suffering not just as punishment, but as a necessary crucible. It purifies, humbles, and ultimately makes spiritual growth possible. Raskolnikov has to endure the consequences, has to go through the Siberian prison sentence to truly begin to change.
And that change isn't driven by logic, is it?
That's the third key point, the power of love and faith over cold reason. Raskolnikov's intellect led him astray. What ultimately saves him, or begins to save him, isn't a new, better theory. It's Sonia's unwavering, unconditional love and her simple, profound faith. Compassion trumps calculation.
Dostoevsky's psychological realism was groundbreaking, too. How he gets inside Raskolnikov's head.
Phenomenal. He uses everything internal monologue, the oppressive atmosphere you mentioned, the symbolism, like the wooden cross Sonia gives Raskolnikov, representing the burden he must carry.
And the dreams. They're so revealing.
Oh, the dreams are crucial. They bypass Raskolnikov's rational defenses and show us his subconscious turmoil. The dream of the peasant beating the old mayor, for instance, it reveals his buried empathy, the horror at cruelty that his conscious philosophy tried to extinguish. His mind is constantly at war with itself.
So the epilogue.
No.
It doesn't offer an easy, happy ending, does it?
Not at all. It's set in Siberia. Raskolnikov is serving his sentence, and Sonia has followed him there. For a long time, he's still sullen, proud, unrepentant, alienated from the other prisoners. He doesn't regret the crime, only that he failed, that he wasn't extraordinary enough.
The transformation is slow, painful.
Very. The final breakthrough comes after another illness, and significantly another dream this time. A terrifying vision of a world destroyed by a plague of pure reason, where everyone thinks only their own ideas are truth, leading to chaos and self-destruction.
That dream finally shatters his intellectual pride.
It seems to. It shows him the logical conclusion of his own initial philosophy, writ large. And after that, when he's recovering by the riverbank, he finally looks at Sonia, truly sees her devotion, and his heart breaks open. Love floods in. The novel ends there, not with him fully redeemed, but with the beginning of his gradual renewal, the promise of a new life.
So, the enduring power of this novel really lies in its fierce defense of a shared moral foundation for humanity, suggesting that purely intellectual theories, detached from love and compassion, are ultimately destructive.
Yeah, I think so. It's a profound reminder that perhaps real strength isn't found in proving superiority, but in accepting our shared human condition, our capacity for both terrible sin and immense love, and finding redemption through humility and connection. Mandatory closing line. This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Acatra Foundation.